From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Okay, this is our suburban sprawl unit, and it is time for a suburban sprawl pop quiz.
Oh, pop quiz!
You doing your homework, doing your studying?
I haven't done anything.
All right, well, here's the first question. What is a lulu?
Ooh,
what is a lulu?
I know.
Brittany.
A lulu is a Hawaiian feast.
No, that's a luau, silly.
No, it's that thing you wear when you go, you know, motorcycle.
Anyone else? Anyone? Anyone? Going once, going twice? No. A lulu is a locally unwanted land use. See, it's an acronym, lulu. All right, you obviously haven't been doing your studying. Let's move on to our next question. A boomburb. How do you define a boomburb? A boomburb can be defined as...
It's the mayor of New York.
No, it is not, Chuck.
It's a computer.
Oh, that's right.
No, it's the new iPod thingy.
Steve?
It is a rapidly growing urban-sized place in the suburbs.
Very good. Well done, Steve.
Whatever.
Very nice.
Mr.
That's
Steve.
Exactly what it is. How about a class? Settle down or we'll never get through this. Yeah. What is a rural slammer? What is a rural slammer?
Why don't you ask Steve?
Yeah, Steve, he knows.
Isn't it? You go first. Go ahead.
Brittany?
It's an alcoholic beverage.
Yeah, that's right. You put the shot in the beer and boom.
No.
Oh,
it is not. It may be, but that is not the answer I'm looking for here. A rural slammer. And
it's a dance.
That new thing.
Ooh, it's the rural slammer.
Slam dancing.
Oh no!
That's it. Yeah.
Good job. Come on, boys and girls. It's a minivan.
Yes, Steve, you finally got one wrong. A rural slammer refers to the construction of remote prisons involving concrete, steel, and lockdown hardware.
It'd be way better if it was a dance.
Okay, but hey, before you go, don't forget, your papers are due next week. Your papers on the Walmart Station of America are due next week.
Man,
okay?
I'm so screwed.
Next Wednesday, 9 a.m.
Let's get out. Let's go have a drink.
9 a.m. Can we have another
question?
This hour on To the Best of Our Knowledge, a field guide to sprawl. First up, sprawl kills. At least according to Joel Hirshhorn. He's the author of the book called Sprawl Kills. Hirshhorn told Steve Paulson what's wrong with sprawl.
Almost everything is wrong with sprawl. It's killing people, making them unhealthy, creating a sedentary lifestyle, because the basic aspect of sprawl, the way I look at it, is its automobile dependency. People got hooked on automobiles because of suburban sprawl developing after World War II. And the other thing that's wrong with sprawl these days, it not only hurts people, it hurts our natural environment. It consumes enormous amounts of land, and we cannot afford this anymore. When sprawl began after World War II, we had a population, roughly about half of what we have now, about 150 million. And with 300 million, and very soon by mid-century, we will easily get to 400 million, we cannot afford to keep putting people into large lots in, you know, once rural areas. Over 50% of all the new single-family homes in the United States are on 5 acres or more. So sprawl is killing everything. It has killed the rural areas. It is killing the rural lifestyle in this country. It has killed small business.
But the irony is that a lot of these people who are buying those 5-acre lots out there, they want a piece of that rural lifestyle. I mean, they may not have a farm, but they want to be out in the country.
Well, an amazing, 30 to 50% of Americans, this is based on lots and lots of research, do not want to live in that sprawl lifestyle. They really want a more urbanized, it may not be city living that they want, but they want to live in a mixed use kind of community, real true community where they can walk to a lot of things, and they want to reduce their automobile dependency.
When you talk about mixed use, you're talking about retail stores right near
Absolutely.
Where people live.
School, stores, entertainment, restaurants, churches, banks, you name it, all within walking distance. And we have hundreds of examples of new communities that are being built all around the country offering this kind of mixed-use, walkable community, much higher social capital, more social interaction, where people really are neighbors. The thing about sprawl is it's social isolation.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned some of these mixed-use communities that have been springing up, and this has been a cornerstone of what's been called the new urbanism. And from what I've heard about a lot of these developments going on, they've been very successful. People have flocked to them.
Absolutely.
And they've often driven up the prices. And it seems that that's one of the dilemmas here is, I mean, what you can get in a subdivision is you can get a a pretty big house for a relatively good price with some land to go with it.
What you're getting to is really the core issue here that people don't talk about enough. The housing industry is really unique because supply determines demand more than demand determines supply. Now, you got to think about that. But what I mean is we have all these people who don't want to live in sprawl. But if sprawl is the only thing, the only form of housing that's being offered in a certain geographical market, they have to live in sprawl.
And that's affordable.
That's true. But it's a kind of false economics, again, that's getting more attention now because it seems like you get a lot of house for the money if you go far and far out, you know, in suburban sprawl. But again, the transportation costs can kill people because of the automobile dependency. And it's not just commuting to work. That's only 25% of car use. It's the other 75%. They have to use their cars for everything in typical sprawl areas. And it's unhealthy also. It's physically, mentally unhealthy to live in suburban sprawl. And we have a tremendous amount of medical research on this. This should not even be questioned at all today.
Now, when you say physically unhealthy, because people are spending more and more time in their cars, you're just saying they're not getting enough exercise?
It's called sedentary death syndrome. It's a sedentary lifestyle that is promoted by sprawl, basically, that car dependency. And people are what I call time poor. And time, ultimately, is more valuable than money. And so when people move to sprawl, I read, you know, talk to people all the time, read these stories, where they have no time for family life. I mean, they say they move to that suburban area to have a better family life, but then they have no time for a good family life. And so, yeah, in every respect, people are stressed out, time poor, sedentary, which makes them obese and overweight. I think there's nothing good about sprawl. That's why I like the term sprawl kills. People say they go for suburban areas because the schools are better. Well, it turns out that all these things are a bunch of lies because suburban sprawl has encouraged large size schools. And the larger the school size, the worse the education. And there's been a tremendous movement in this country, which very few people seem to know. It's called the small school movement. And again, when we talk about true community, you know, new urbanism or smart growth, mixed use, the idea of having smaller neighborhood schools, community schools, is very important because the quality of the education is better.
But certainly we've heard so many stories about the poor quality of schools in many big cities, many metropolitan areas.
Again, I'm glad you brought this up because the worst thing is to compare suburban sprawl to inner city living. And suburbia is just geography. And what we have to think about is a different style of land development and housing in suburban locations. I totally accept the fact that most Americans don't want to move back to the inner cities.
So you're not saying sprawl is the same as suburbia?
Absolutely not. I'm saying just the opposite. I'm saying when you look at new communities and new towns throughout the country built on smart growth or new urbanism principles, they're in suburban locations. Absolutely. But they are kind of micro cities, if you will, small, mixed use, mixed income housing. And it turns out we have all this data that says, you know, this alternative to sprawl really works. Research has been done on it. And the research shows every study that people, you know, have better neighbors in non-sprawl places. Hmm. They like the places better. They are more civically engaged, more politically engaged. Sprawl it's that social isolation which has caused over 50 years, you know, a lot of civic disengagement.
So if there are all these people who actually don't want to live in sprawl and want to live in these mixed-use, higher-density areas, why can't they? What's stopping
them? And the light bulb one day went on in my head when I was studying this, when I was with the National Governors Association, and I had to answer that question because we had all this data. I actually bought the market research that developers pay for, and that showed me clearly that all this demand for alternatives to sprawl was really there out there in the marketplace. And the only way to explain why we're not building enough alternatives to sprawl is what I call sprawl politics. Fact is, there's a sprawl industry, and there are a group of what I call sprawl shills, mostly right-wing conservative types who are very pro-sprawl, very pro-car. And this industry, together with the right-wing sprawl shills, have corrupted government at every level, local, state, and federal, so that the sprawl industry, which is the land developers, the speculators, the home builders, the real estate industry, big box stores, fast food restaurant chains, all kinds of business sectors that love sprawl. They have corrupted government both legally and illegally so that if you're a land developer, the game is stacked against you to build any kind of alternative to sprawl. That's just the way it is in terms of land use regulations and policies and practices in most of the country.
Well, let me ask you about whether people really want to live in a high density situation. I mean, do people really
yes.
want to live above a store
Absolutely.
And with people, you know, stacked right next to them?
They do. And here's the big issue. Design trumps density. You have to have really good design if you go into a high density situation. If you don't have good design, people will reject high density. But all around the country, we've had hundreds, if not thousands, of what we call visual preference surveys. And that is, you show people pictures. And if you show them pictures of well-designed, high-density housing, living situations versus sort of sprawl kinds of situations, lots of big houses, lots of land, they always prefer the high-density alternatives. I mean, this has been shown hundreds and hundreds of times. Not everyone, of course, but a very high fraction of people will choose and do choose the high-density alternative. I can tell you that the apartments above stores and all the places I've looked at around the country are usually the first ones to sell out. They are extremely popular.
You're saying people don't want like a little yard in the back where they can have a garden?
They want a little yard. You can get a little yard in a new urbanism kind of place, but I'm talking about a really small yard. What good are all these, you know, large yards, large lawns? What purpose do they serve? You know, people don't sort of jog around their own lawns. I mean, they don't even mow their own lawn. So you can't even argue that they're getting any, you know, physical activity from mowing their own lawns, you know. So lawns don't, you know, it's a sort of false kind of green space. What you want is green space in your neighborhood that you can actually use where you can, you know, jog or ride a bicycle or skate, you know, whatever, play ball fields. That's what you need for people to physically interact and to be physically active. Lawns are useless. I mean, really, what a waste of fertilizer and water, natural resources we have in this country because of this lawn mentality. It's absolute insanity.
Joel Hirshhorn's the author of Sprawl Kills, How Bland Burbs Steal Your Time, Health, and Money. But au contraire, coming up next, a critique of the anti-sprawl movement.
When planners or anyone else, architects or any other group, believes that because of their superior training, they have the right and the duty to decide how other people should live. And therefore, rather than taking the time to really look carefully at what's there, they jump to the next step, decide what they think it should be, and therefore they're proselytizing on behalf of a particular outcome. That, I think, has been the problem in this whole debate.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Robert Brugman says sprawl gets a bad rap. He also says that much of what we think we know about the suburbs and sprawl is simply wrong. He's the author of Sprawl, A Compact History, and says suburban sprawl has given us everything we cherish as Americans: privacy, mobility, and choice. Not a popular stance in a world where it seems everyone is decrying sprawl and celebrating so-called smart growth.
I think that sprawl is one of those terms that has never had an exact definition because the people who use it have very good reasons not wanting it to be defined very exactly, the biggest reason of which is that if they did, most of the people who are against it would realize they live in it. So I think that actually sprawl is just a bad diagnostic tool. It covers a lot of problems, some of them very important, like, let's say, global warming, some of them really pretty trivial, and it puts them all together in a big bag and assumes there's one single solution, which is higher density, less sprawl. And I don't think that either the diagnosis nor the prescription is a very good one.
Well, maybe we need to start then with a definition of sprawl so that we can have a reasonable discussion about the same thing.
Right.
What do you use as a definition of sprawl?
Well, for purposes of history, of doing a history of sprawl, I use a definition that it's less dense settlement than what went before, and it's often scattered, and there is no overarching master plan. And by that definition, sprawl is not, as most people, I think, recent American and driven by the automobile, but it's as old as urban history. And it's something that happens every time a new group of people is able to get out of the congestion of central cities. They've taken that opportunity.
I guess what occurs to me as we talk about it, though, is that each of us has a kind of emotional definition of sprawl. I think about the years when I lived on the East Coast and drove up and down the Boston Post Road,
right.
And it seemed as though you could drive forever and never leave the city. That was what I always thought of as sprawl, not going into the New Jersey countryside and discovering that there are some very beautiful places where people have nice houses and live quite comfortably.
Right. Well, and of course, I think for most people, going back to as long as people have been angry about sprawl, and that goes back all the way to the Roman times, that people were angry about people moving out of the city and cluttering up the countryside, the vast majority of these complaints are essentially aesthetic or, let's call it, symbolic. And that's fine. And everyone has a perfect right not to like that sprawl that you see when you drive between Boston and Washington. But I think that before we go trying to change the whole thing, we need to find out why it happened and all the benefits that it's created for millions of people over centuries. And I think only then are we really in a position to say, well, is this more important than our aesthetic preferences?
One of the things, though, that it seems obvious that sprawl is at the root of is this question of eating up the land and of increasing the reliance on the automobile to get us from here to there. Do you agree with that?
Yes, but we have to take each of them independently because they're completely different issues. Eating up the land. In the first place, at least in the United States, we've eaten up very little land. It's 5% or less. We could fit the whole population of the United States at suburban densities into the state of Wisconsin. There's plenty of land. It's not that we're lacking of it. Some people worry about agriculture. Agriculture, again, we are using less land than we were using, let's say, 30 years ago, but we're producing more because of the Green Revolution. Now, let's take the other question here, which is about transportation. People assume, and it's the first thing that people assume when they talk about sprawl in the United States, that because things are spread out more, that the business is further from the home and further from places of recreation, that therefore there have to be longer commutes, more congestion, more pollution. In fact, that equation is almost backward. That is, yes, the businesses have moved out and the people have moved out, but because both are moving out, it has not meant that commutes are longer, at least in time. In time, those commutes have remained relatively stable. They are still 20 to 30 minutes what they've been probably since the beginning of recorded history.
That seems counterintuitive if you're farther away from work, or is that the essence?
But you're not. But you're not further away from work. You may be physically a little bit further, but your speed of travel is much greater. And what's really made that happen is that the automobile is a much more efficient way of getting from point A to point B than public transportation in any city, except for a very few, very large cities to get from in the intermediate area into the center. So if you're in Paris or in New York and you want to get from the first suburb in into the center, public transportation may be your fastest way to do it. Anywhere else, and even in those cities, and not in that case, getting someplace by public transportation is almost always at least twice as time-consuming as it is to take the automobile. And that's why the automobile use has risen astronomically in Europe as it has in the United States. In fact, it's the same trajectory, just with a time lag.
Well, that makes sense. But what about those appalling McMansions that people build?
I think anyone that's trained in a particular set of aesthetic preferences that we can label as, I think, upper middle class, they are appalled by those McMansions. But, you know, I think if you take a bigger perspective on that and you look back only to, let's say, the 1880s or the 1920s, and you see the British aristocracy absolutely appalled at those houses that the wealthy bankers were putting up in the Cotswolds and the Chilterns outside of London, it's exactly the same aesthetic negative reaction, as is the case in the 1920s, when affluent people were going out to the suburbs and putting up big Tudor houses that, of course, the intellectual and artistic elite of the day thought was the most ridiculous thing they had ever seen and roundly disliked them. But in almost every one of these cases, one generation later, those very same people have changed their mind, and suddenly those things aren't so bad. In fact, they look pretty good, given the monstrosities that they, or what they believe to be the monstrosities going up in that day.
One of the illustrations that appealed to me in the book was of the row houses in the suburbs of London,
yeah,
which were denigrated by everybody. They thought they were just appalling.
Well, they were denigrated by people in the artistic and literary world. They certainly were not denigrated by the majority of Londoners, who were absolutely delighted to move into them.
A little bit of garden was
absolutely
appealing.
So when we're talking about aesthetics, I think it's the purest example of kind of class-based assumptions. I think that all the arguments about sprawl are heavily influenced by these class-based assumptions, but you see it most clearly when we're talking about aesthetics.
A lot of people talk about the solution to this whole thing being to increase the density of the inner cities, to go up rather than out.
Right, right.
Is there any indication that that is an effective response to the question of sprawl?
Well, it's an effective response if people are willing to do it. Now, if you had complete power, let's say you were in Soviet Union or you were in Hong Kong or Singapore, you can do that and get away with it. It's not possible in most cases to do it in the Western democracies, because if there's one thing people dislike more than sprawl at the edge, it's high density at the center if it's near them. And it's the very same people who are complaining if you build out in sprawl. They're the very same people who will complain if you're building higher density in the center city. What they'll say, and it's perfectly true, is that to do that destroys the character of the neighborhood in the central city.
Residential neighborhoods really don't want more large apartment buildings in them, do they?
Mostly. That's mostly true. And I should say that most people don't want to live in apartment buildings. Most people, and I'm talking worldwide now, when they're asked, and this has been tested in poll after poll after poll, where do you want to live? They may say single-family house, they may say bungalow, they may say cottage, they may say country house, but it's going to be some species of single-family detached house. In no poll have I ever seen anywhere have the majority of people said, oh, I want to live in an apartment building, I want to live in a big, tall high-rise. It's just not what most people seem to want.
So is what you're saying that we need to simply look more closely at the argument that we're having? I don't get the sense from you that you are opposed to the idea of urban planning.
No, not at all. No, not at all. I teach urban planning history. I believe in urban planning. But I think that with urban planning, there's been an unfortunate confusion about what it's supposed to do. I think that if urban planners said that their goal was to analyze very clearly what's out there, document that, put it into good, usable form, talk about the different alternative scenarios for future development, and then put those into the political arena to be decided by the political process, I don't think most people would have any problem with that. It's when something else happens. It's when planners or anyone else, architects or any other group, believes that because of their superior training, they have the right and the duty to decide how other people should live. And therefore, rather than taking the time to really look carefully at what's there, they jump to the next step, decide what they think it should be, and therefore they're proselytizing on behalf of a particular outcome. That, I think, has been the problem in this whole debate.
It sounds to me as though you're almost saying sprawl is going to happen no matter what you do, and you ought to stop worrying about sprawl and start worrying about the specific issues that are of concern to you, sprawl not being essentially one of them.
Well, I think that rather than say that, I would say that there are a lot of issues involved with what people call sprawl, and they're very different and they have very different solutions, and that, yes, we ought to be looking specifically at species protection or global warming or problems of concentrated poverty. These are real problems. We need to address them. But I don't think they're all the same thing or they have the same solutions. In fact, sometimes the solutions go in different directions altogether. This is a very complicated issue, and many of the places that we're talking about, let's say the Napa Valley in California, very few people consider that sprawl at all, partly because it's wealthy people with very good taste, and that's hardly ever considered sprawl, no matter how low density it is. And it's partly because these are people who have tried to keep it looking rural as much as they possibly can.
Sprawl is the Boston Post Road, not Napa Valley.
That's exactly right.
Robert Brugman's the author of Sprawl, A Compact History. So you think the U.S. has sprawl issues? Go to China. They have more mega cities than you can shake a stick at. And those cities keep growing and growing and growing, along with the Chinese economy, at a staggering rate. And what fuels this growth? Chinese factories making our stuff. Large-scale photographer Edward Bertinsky traveled to China to photograph China's Industrial Revolution. Jennifer Bichwal documented his trip in her film Manufactured Landscapes. The film, like the photographs, is stunning for both its beauty and its tragedy. Jennifer Bichwal spoke with Steve Paulson about the Bertinsky photos.
These photographs presuppose the ideal of a pristine landscape. They're kind of like the fallen world in a way. There aren't many places left in the world where you can experience pristine landscape. And when you think about how difficult it is to photograph that kind of landscape without falling into all kinds of cliches, you know, how do you do a photograph of pristine nature that is compelling and doesn't feel like you're looking at a calendar? His work certainly, I think, presupposes the fact that this landscape once existed and we are changing a lot of the shape of the earth, of the planet, by the way that we live.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you say that. It's almost as if he has taken the old style that Ansel Adams used to do. You know, he would go out west and do these magnificent photographs of great natural wonders, but Ed Bertinsky has done that of fantastic manufactured scenes.
Exactly. And sometimes, I mean, I've been in these landscapes with him in these contexts, and it's not easy to see the beauty there. I mean, when you see the photographs, they're stunningly beautiful. They're aesthetically very compelling, which is part of the paradox of the work, because you're looking at something that has, you know, swirls of color and is incredibly intriguing aesthetically. And when you get in closer, you realize that you're looking at garbage. You're looking at densified oil filters or, you know, billions of little electronic parts in a pile of e-waste. And then you kind of recoil at the subject matter. So there's this real push and pull in his work, this ambiguity at the heart of it, where you're drawn in aesthetically and then you are repulsed in some way by the content. And something about that reaction allows you, I think, to meditate on your own impact on the planet, what you do to the world by living in it, and the cycles of consumption and waste that we all, sometimes incredibly unconsciously, engage in.
I had a bit of an epiphany being lost in Pennsylvania, and I took a left turn trying to get back to the highway, and I ended up in a town called Frackville. And I got out of the car, and I stood up, and it was a coal mining town, and I did a 360 turnaround, and that became one of the most surreal landscapes I'd ever seen, totally transformed by man. And that got me to go out and look at the largest industrial incursions that I could find. And that became the baseline of what I was doing. I guess in the back of everybody's mind, if you think of extraction industries, that we all know that stuff comes from somewhere, but we're disconnected from that. So my images brought those landscapes into our consciousness. And for about 10 years, I explored that kind of landscape through quarries and mines, nickel or copper or iron ore, and ones that had been going on for long periods of time, so that the evidence of that accumulated taking in one frame, you can show the dimensions of our extraction in the landscape.
Well, I was especially struck by some of the scenes of, I guess, what is called e-waste, recycled computers, and a huge percentage of recycled computers from around the world end up in China in these huge dumps, and they are compressed, and they are beautiful in your film and in his photographs. I mean, to me, they look like modern art, right? Sort of this kind of compressed metallic sculpture that could be hanging in a museum somewhere.
And yet, the reality of that e-waste, it is true that 50% of the world's e-waste gets shipped to China, perhaps more, but it is technically illegal there, recycling e-waste. So it's this huge underground cottage industry, and you have whole small villages and towns that are devoted to e-waste recycling, with people sitting on their porches breaking apart computers and monitors, and of course all of the toxic metals that are used in the process of making these things simply leach into the groundwater and into the ground, to the point where in some places the water is so contaminated they have to have water shipped in. And then, because it is illegal, and it's illegal because they do not have proper facilities to do this, sometimes these people take it indoors to do it in secret, and you have these, you know, they're burning wires to get the rubber off of the precious metals inside in non-ventilated areas. So there's this huge problem with how we deal with things after we throw them away. And there's something about these photographs that allow you to witness the places that you are responsible for but would never normally see, the margins of this cycle of consumption and waste, where the things that we use every day are made and where they go after we throw them away and they're no longer useful to us. And I think once you see these places, once you are in these places, it's impossible not to have your consciousness changed.
At one point I was shooting a mine, and it was a silver mine.
Okay, it's a little dark.
I arrive in my car, made out of iron, you know, filled with gas. I'd pull out a metal tripod and grab film that's loaded with silver and start taking pictures. So everything that I'm doing is connected to the thing I'm photographing. Looking at these ships, the connection was clear. At some point, I probably filled a tank of gas from the oil that was delivered by one of these tankers.
Why did Ed Bertinsky go all the way to China to take these photographs? I mean, presumably he could have found these kinds of manufactured landscapes in other places as well.
Well, it's interesting because Bertinsky started photographing quarries. And in a way, quarries are the most beautiful sort of metaphor for literally the hole we make in the ground to take out the materials we need to make the things that we want to make. And a lot of those quarries were in North America. A lot of them were in Vermont. And he photographed mines, which were in Canada, tailings ponds in Canada. He went all over North America, essentially. And when he thought about, you know, what happens when I throw this computer away, what happens to it? So he followed his computer to China. It was e-waste that started him there, just like the shipbreaking series that he did in Bangladesh came out of a thought of what happens, you know, I fill up my car with a tank of gas in my car from oil that has been shipped from a tanker somewhere. What happens to those tankers when they die? And he's recognizing that we live much more in a small world where there are places in the world where these things go that nobody gets to see. And he started in China because of e-waste, but also, you know, perhaps the biggest industrial revolution in history is happening in China at the moment. And the scale of it is so much bigger than anything that has gone on before that I think he wanted to witness that historic moment with his photographs and try to record it.
Can you give me some sense of that scale in China? Just how big are some of these industrial productions?
Well, I mean, when you think about it, like, this is happening so rapidly. It's happening rapidly, and it's happening on a massive scale in China. So, for example, the energy needs of China are vast, and there are 3 to 5 coal-burning power plants going in a week there in order to keep up with the demand of energy. These factories are massive. I mean, there's a place called the Yuyang Shoe Factory, for example, that has 90,000 workers, essentially.
90,000 workers in one factory.
There's a shift change 3 times a day, 30,000 workers. It runs 24 hours a day, so 30,000 workers change hands 3 times a day in shifts. And that's how many people work in this factory. And they make more shoes than any other factory in the world. what's tragic about these places is that so far, and there's no question that China knows exactly what's going on here and is trying to deal with it, but there are no real environmental regulations in these factories. That's why they're there in China and not here in North America. You can pay people less, there's lots of labor, cheap labor, and there are no environmental regulations. So all the dyes and glues and the things that are used to make these things just go right out into the waterways. And it's coming to a real crisis because of that fact. And so it's not like China doesn't know what they're doing. They're doing what every other industrialized country has done, which is, you know, industrialize now, make money, get dirty, clean up later. But they just may not have the luxury of making the same mistakes as other industrialized countries because the scale is so big. And there are already people there like Pan Yu, who is the Deputy Minister of the Environment, who is very aware of the environmental catastrophes that China faces because of this rapid industrialization. And because essentially, you know, every dirty industry from around the world has set up shop there in the last, whatever, 20 years.
Well, how do you approach the ethics of the subject that you've taken on? Because on the one hand, you are putting forward some very beautiful images. And yet, as you say, the environmental consequences are disastrous. I mean, how do you square those two things?
Well, you know, I consider myself to be a fairly environmentally aware person. And I do think that existing environmental discourses, certainly in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, I suppose, failed to move people because they were too polarizing and didactic. So there were very much this sort of us and them mentality where if you did not live in the country and become an organic farmer and make your own clothes, you were doomed, you know, ethically to failure because you were participating in an urban life or you were driving a car or anything like that or buying clothes made halfway around the world. And I think that because they were so radical, they fail to move ordinary people to change their lives. And there's something about the way that Bertinsky's photographs work, which is an invitation to witness rather than a didactic argument, an invitation to experientially feel what these places are like and then to meditate on your own place in all of this, that I think is an alternative way of shifting consciousness. And I certainly felt like that when I first saw these photographs, which is probably the main reason why I wanted to make this film. And I wanted the film to do what the photographs do, which is profoundly shift consciousness, environmental consciousness, but in a completely non-didactic way.
There are times when I have thought about my work and putting it into a more politicized environment. If I said, this is a terrible thing that we're doing to the planet, then people will either agree or disagree. By not saying what you should see, that may allow them to look at something that they never looked at and to see their world a little differently. So I think many people today sit in that uncomfortable spot where, you know, we don't necessarily want to give up what we have, but we realize what we're doing is creating problems that run deep. It's not a simple right or wrong. It needs a whole new way of thinking.
Jennifer Bechtwald's documentary film is called Manufactured Landscapes. For more on the film or on the photography of Edward Bertinsky, please go to our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, novelist and screenwriter Tom Pirotta on moving to the suburbs.
It's like a lot of other things in our life. I mean, we all become middle-aged when you're young. It seems like you couldn't possibly. It's not going to happen to me. That happens to other people. And then one day you look at yourself and you're there. And I don't know why we have to beat ourselves up about it.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
This isn't a formal interview, the superintendent told her. We're just trying to get the facts straight. What facts? Said Ruth.
Tom Perotta, reading from his novel The Abstinence Teacher.
The principal and the superintendent turned to the lawyer, who didn't look too happy. Ms. Ramsey, did you advocate the practice of fellatio to your students? Did I what? The lawyer glanced at his yellow pad. Last Thursday, in sixth period health, in response to a question by Teresa McBride? When Ruth realized what he was talking about, she laughed with relief. Not just fellatio, she explained. Cunnilingus, too. I would never single out just the one. The lawyer frowned. He was a slovenly guy in a cheap suit, the kind of attorney you sometimes saw on TV, blinking frantically, trying to explain why he'd fallen asleep during his client's murder trial. Stonewood Heights was a relatively prosperous town, but Ruth sometimes got the feeling that the people in charge didn't mind cutting a few corners. And you're telling us you advocated these practices? I didn't advocate them, Ruth said. If I remember correctly, I think what I said is that some people like oral sex. Joe Venuti let out a soft groan of dismay. Dr. Farmer looked like he'd been jabbed with a pin. Are you absolutely certain? The lawyer asked in an insinuating tone. Why don't you take a moment and think about it? Because if you're being misquoted, it would make everything a lot easier. By now, it had finally dawned on Ruth that she might be in some kind of trouble. You want me to say I didn't say it? It would be a relief, admitted Dr. Farmer. Save us all a big headache.
It's Tom Perotta, reading from his novel The Abstinence Teacher. It's set in the suburbs, like all of Perotta's novels, and deals with suburban issues, like sex ed in the schools, or the politics of the soccer team bake sale, or the existential crisis of suddenly realizing you're a grown-up with a family and a mortgage. Anne Strainchamp sat down with Tom Perotta to talk about writing, the suburbs, and his most celebrated novel, Little Children.
I would say that with both Little Children and The Abstinence Teacher, I've been kind of coming to terms with my own recent experience as a parent. So Little Children is really about the shock of new parenthood when you sort of have to surrender your own narrative and basically start living for your kid, or at least that's how it feels for a little while. And so the main character, Sarah, in Little Children is a 30-ish woman who is having a very, very hard time adjusting to being a mom. And this is the first paragraph of the first chapter, which is called Bad Mommy. The young mothers were telling each other how tired they were. This was one of their favorite topics, along with the eating, sleeping, and defecating habits of their offspring, the merits of certain local nursery schools, and the difficulty of sticking to an exercise routine. Smiling politely to mask a familiar feeling of desperation, Sarah reminded herself to think like an anthropologist. I'm a researcher studying the behavior of boring suburban women. I am not a boring suburban woman myself.
Yeah, there are so many of us of a certain age who have been there completely.
But then what's interesting is why we educated moms tend to feel defensive about the choices we made that led us to live in what looks like sort of the American dream. You know, the American suburb in the way that we're describing it is kind of a dream. You know, it's a nice place, nice houses, safe playgrounds, good schools, good real estate values. So why do we feel defensive about having wound up there? There's something about how we feel about suburbs that's, we both want to live there, but we don't want to be the kind of people who live there.
I know, isn't it fascinating? I mean, a lot of it, as I say, you know, Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique and basically talked about the suburbs and being a housewife as a kind of soul-deadening occupation, something that basically deprived a woman of her full potential. And so a whole generation of women, I think, were raised with that image. And yet there is something that almost feels necessary. I mean, it's hard to imagine, you know, where else you go and have a life if you're living in an urban area and you want your kids to have a yard to play in and good schools to go to. And so suddenly this destiny that seemed like something to be avoided starts to seem inevitable. It's like a lot of other things in our life. You know, we all become middle-aged. when you're young, it seems like you couldn't possibly. That's not going to happen to me. That happens to other people. And then one day you look at yourself and you're there, and I don't know why we have to beat ourselves up about it.
I was wondering if it has something to do with niceness, really, because the suburbs are really very nice places, but there is a kind of tyranny of niceness. You know, I mean, you write about that, well, in this book, Little Children, in which one of the things that happens is a convicted child molester moves into the neighborhood and suddenly people aren't so nice anymore, are they?
Well, you know, the ordinary parents like Sarah, I think, become alarmed and a little bit scared, but there are a few people who become, you know, unhinged to the point of taking on some vigilante action. There's one guy in particular who's an ex-cop who basically makes it his full-time job to torment this child molester and see if he can't, you know, drive him out of the town.
It's for liberal parents like these, I don't know which would be worse, you know, feeling angry at having a convicted child molester move next door or feeling guilty because you're angry at having a convicted child molester next door. Do you know what I mean?
Well, yeah. No, it's very funny. This is the first time I've mentioned this. About a month ago, one of my neighbors knocked on my door and informed me that in this, you know, very nice suburban town that I live in Massachusetts, in the house next door, a level 3 sex offender, which in Massachusetts is the, I believe, the highest registration you can have and be out of jail, had just registered to move into the house next door to me. And this particular dad who lived across the street was, you know, he was mounting a campaign basically to convince the landlord who had rented to this guy to get him out. And it was, you know, the guy across the street didn't know that I was a writer and didn't know that I had actually written something about this.
He hadn't read your book.
Right.
Which, did you want to say you might want to read my novel first?
Well, he was like the character. And he basically said to the landlord, he said, if you do this, you know, I will camp out on your front lawn. And I will make your life hell. And ultimately, you know, a lot of neighbors called because the man who was moving in had just a horrible history of violent sex crimes.
And, so what did you say?
You know, when it came down to it, I didn't want him there either. He has to live somewhere, but I don't want him to live next door. And in that sense, you know, because I just didn't want to live thinking, you know, if I leave my house for a little while and my kids, you know, I don't want to just be worried every minute.
So did you do anything?
I called the guy and said I would really be much happier if he didn't live next door.
What did he say?
By that point, he had heard from so many other people that he said, I know, it's not going to happen.
Huh.
So, and you know what? I didn't feel any guilt about it. It's funny, as a novelist, I you know, really do want to imagine the life over there and to think about what it means to be, you know, a sex offender in a suburban community. But when it came down to it, did I want a violent sexual criminal living next door to me? No, and it almost felt like a kind of the liberal getting mugged by reality. You know, it's all well and good inside a novel, but when it's your next door neighbor, it didn't seem so, empathy didn't come so easily.
And is there a way, do you think, in which that whole exchange is somehow typical of the suburbs, of the kind of dilemma that we set ourselves by creating places like the suburbs that are so very, very nice?
I don't know. You know, there's a brief section from Little Children that I was thinking about, which there's a town meeting where the people are trying to come to terms with the presence of the pedophile in the neighborhood, and I thought it might be interesting to read a little of that.
That'd be great.
Okay. The auditorium was packed. Todd recognized a lot of faces from the various playgrounds he and Aaron had visited over the past year and a half, and there seemed to be a general sentiment among the crowd that you weren't doing your duty as a citizen and parent if you didn't stand up to express your strenuous disapproval of sex offenders and demand to know what the town was going to do to ensure the safety of Bellington's children and prevent any further erosion of property values. Maybe you should put up a new sign, one angry man suggested to enthusiastic applause. Entering Bellington, a pervert-friendly town. The officials on stage, the mayor, the chief of police, and the school psychologist, kept patiently dispensing the same advice over and over. We can protect our children by making sure we know exactly where they are and who they're with at every moment in the day. Don't send a young child to the store or even down the street to a neighbor's house without an escort. But take these precautions calmly, without creating an atmosphere of panic. Childhood should be a time of innocence, not anxiety. For its part, the police department was stepping up its surveillance of parks and playgrounds and closely monitoring McGorvey's activities.
Yeah, there's a kind of wanting it both ways, isn't there? I don't know, I guess I was thinking, I know that you're a big admirer of The Great Gatsby, and I was thinking sort of about the suburbs as this apotheosis of the American dream, this place where every kid gets to grow up safe and happy and in which we live safe and happy lives, except then the problem is, you know, you get it and it turns out to be not what you want, or to be boring or not interesting enough or somehow deeply unfulfilling. And maybe that's sort of become a very uniquely American dilemma.
It is, isn't it? And then you do get to go to college and get away from all that and maybe spend your 20s in an exciting urban area and then retreat back. You know, it's become a pattern of American life. You know, this pattern of escape and return. We find it oppressive, and yet the safety of it and the niceness of it is very appealing at certain points in our lives.
Tom Perata is the author of Little Children. He was nominated for an Academy Award for his screenplay adaptation. Perata also read from his novel The Abstinence Teacher. Anne Strangeham spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to take a Field Guide to Sprawl quiz, go to our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for To Sprawl or Not to Sprawl, program number 23B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strangeham, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.